Ladies and gentlemen, our first case for argument is Wausau Underwriters v. United Plastics. Mr. Swofford.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Swofford on behalf of Ohio Casualty Company. And this is an insurance coverage case brought to determine whether Ohio Casualty's insurance policy covers a Texas judgment that was entered against its insured United Plastics and in favor of a company called Microtherm. Microtherm was the manufacturer of some tankless water heaters, which is sort of a misnomer because they did have tanks. They're more like on-demand water heaters with small plastic tanks and an internal heating element. And it contracted with United Plastics to have United Plastics furnish these small plastic tanks to be incorporated into these tankless heaters. And because United Plastics molded the tanks at inadequate temperatures, they were defective and leaked. Microtherm then sued United Plastics on various theories, seeking damages for lost profits, cost of repairs and replacements, loss of business opportunity, loss of goodwill. The jury found against United Plastics and in favor of Microtherm, and it found, among other things, it found that United Plastics committed the following false, misleading, and deceptive acts, including failing to disclose information about goods or services that was known at the time of the transaction with the intention to induce Microtherm into the transaction it otherwise not would have entered into.
Mr. Swofford, does the jury's verdict in Texas, this $26.5 million or so verdict, distinguish between how much of that damage is attributable to the failed product versus how much is attributable to other things? And does it also give any sense of the time periods when the damage occurred?
Well, I mean, of the only under $100,000 of the judgment was for the cost to repair these items, and all the rest was economic damages for lost profits and loss of the value of Microtherm.
So isn't this case really all about whether that $100,000 hook is enough to pull you in on the rest of it?
Isn't it about whether the $100,000 what?
Well, the $100,000, would you concede that the $100,000 of damages for the cost of repair of the products is the kind of thing the policy covers?
It is generally the kind of thing, yeah, I'm sure there's within that $100,000 some damages that the policy covers. It may not be property damage, for instance, just the cost of replacing the tanks wouldn't be covered, but, you know, basically that is something that's in the nature of what the policy covers, $100,000, yes.
So if the policy covers that, then is it your argument that that's all you have to indemnify, or do you have, how do you get to zero?
Well, we're an excess insurer, and we only insure over $1 million, so the parties would just, there was no point to ever litigate what the components of that $100,000 were, because for that matter, Microtherms have already received $4.3 million from other insurers, so it's just, mm-hmm. It was academic. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Ohio Casualty does maintain that the judgment is not covered other than perhaps the $100,000, which we can just set aside, because United Plastics did not become this, in the words of the policy.
Well, if a tire bursts and the car crashes and you've written insurance on the tire, with coverage for damages because of property damage, then would you be liable for the damage to the car?
Of course, but that is property damage itself.
So you would?
Pardon? Yeah. Yeah, we'd be liable that, because that.
Yeah, similarly here, if the tank bursts and causes damage to the rest of the water heating unit, you'd be liable for that damage.
That's correct.
And that's what that $100,000 is? Or it could be? I suppose it could be.
That's part of what the $100,000 is, yes, replacing defective tankless water heaters. Yes. But we never got into...
I suppose in the automobile case that it's a taxi cab, and because it's been smashed, the owner of the cab loses cab revenues. Now, is that damage because of property damage?
I would think not, Your Honor. Although that gets to be a close question.
Well,
I don't think he could recover. I mean, our argument is more that he couldn't recover for the cost of his business. He couldn't, you know, relate this out.
It's because of property damage, isn't it? Right.
Because
the tire burst, the cab crashed.
Well,
the business was lost. So why isn't that? It's not property damage, but why isn't it lost because of property?
Because because the policy covers tangible losses and it's an intangible loss.
The policy covered losses because of property insurance.
Because of property damage, but
what is the exact language?
Because of property damage. It's because of bodily injury or property damage.
Well, you said tangible. What's the tangible?
Well, the definition of property damage in the policy.
No, we know what property damage. The question is because of property damage. Because of property damage. Now, property damage can cause additional damage, right? And then that additional damage is because of property damage.
Well, that's not the way the policy has been interpreted in Illinois by the Supreme Court, nor even by this court.
Where is the language of the policy on which you rely?
Pardon?
What is the language of the policy on which you rely?
Legally obligated to pay by reason because of property damage. Now, you can read because of... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That can certainly be interpreted as... Any consequence of property damage is covered.
It can be, but it hasn't been in this jurisdiction. It has been interpreted liability because of property damage in the sense of what the insured became liable for in property damage.
What do you rely on?
Well, I could rely on Travelers versus Elger, where there were defective plumbing systems, and the court said that the court distinguished between the various losses.
What was the language of the policy?
In Elger, yeah.
I believe it was because of property damage.
Well, that's kind of critical. So you ought to be sure one way or the other.
I don't have it up here with me. I'm sure I'm almost positive it was because of property damage. In Travelers versus Penda, this court held that where there were defective styrene plates furnished for photographics, that the policy covered the damage to the ultimate person who was using these plates.
What's the language of that policy?
Well, I think I don't have it up here with me, Your Honor. That is typical language out of all these commercial general policies and before that comprehensive liability policies. That's why I'm fairly confident in saying that those were those policies said, but I don't have them up here.
I think your whole case turns on that, actually.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because Travelers versus Elger said that commercial expectations was not covered by this type of policy.
Well, it depends what the policy says.
Well, the appellate court cases, I'm almost positive, said the same language because of property damage, and they reached the same conclusion.
Are you speaking of Monticello? Which case are you talking about?
Diamond State and Chester Jensen.
Okay.
I mean, I just don't. The way the district court analyzed this was because there was any incidental property damage the whole loss was covered. And my case doesn't really turn on because of property damage, even in the broader sense, because there's been no, because this loss of $17.5 million was because these heaters didn't work, and that's fairly evident. That's even the way that they...
Why didn't they work? They didn't work because of this property damage.
No, they didn't work because they leaked. And there's a fundamental difference, because they can leak all day long, and if they don't otherwise hurt the unit or otherwise don't leak on the floor, that is not property damage.
How many of them leaked? I just want to remember of the total number out there in the market, how many of them caused problems?
At the trial before Judge Dara, the owner of the company testified that there were 65 units involving 100 leaks. With regard to UPG's, United Plastics water tanks.
Right. I mean, I thought the overall numbers were higher. I think one of the issues here is, obviously, starting from the language of the policy is critical, but then another one is how far out do we go, you know, kind of in a house that Jack built kind of sense, because the verdict in Texas did go out as far as awarding lost past profits, lost future profits, damage to the value of the company, and a bunch of other things like that. And it depends where you're going to draw the line on causation, doesn't it?
It does, and I actually don't find an answer in the cases for that. I mean, I could refer you to one of this court's decisions. Mm-hmm.
No, I know that the Illinois courts, and everybody seems to be vociferously telling us that Illinois law applies. I can't quite figure out why there's so much discussion of this, given the fact that everyone seems to agree.
I discussed it because there's of a prior opinion of this court that said where the parties weren't on record as agreeing that there was a possible issue. So I raised it and spent mm-hmm. a page in my brief on it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
No, that's okay. Why, thinking of burden of proof for a minute, why wasn't it your burden to show that the expected or intended language was an exclusion from coverage and therefore you have the burden of proof on it?
Well, because the initial burden is always on the insured to bring himself within the ambit of the coverage granted.
Right.
And the coverage granted in this case was property damages as a result of an occurrence. And the parties are arguing about what an occurrence is under Illinois law.
Right.
But I mean the standard that my opponents themselves are advancing is the only correct standard, which we disagree with, is the expected intended. So they're tacitly saying that in order to bring themselves with an occurrence, there has to be expected and intended. And the fact that the same language shows up in an exclusion doesn't, you know, that doesn't mean that that gets them within the initial grant of coverage. So, I mean, I do think the shifting of the burden of proof in this case is could be significant.
But it does seem to me your case actually at this first level depends on our willingness or it depends on whether Illinois law permits in policies comparable to this one, the characterization of all of these economic damages to Microtherm as opposed to property damages, the value of the business, the properties, the value of the business and the profits, depends on our ability to characterize that as outside the scope of property damage.
Well, my opponents have cited any Illinois case that.
You don't have any cases either. They have a lot of cases from other jurisdictions about which you don't respond to in your reply brief about award of consequential damages as a result of property damage.
Yeah.
I thought you were relying on Elger, where the Illinois Supreme Court says the phrase physical injury does not include intangible damage to property, such as economic loss. Isn't that your key case?
Of
course physical injury doesn't include these intangibles, but the language of your policy is because of physical injury. Physical injury causes these intangible losses. There's nothing to do with what physical injury is.
Well, that's, I understand how you're reading because of, but I mean we just read the policy different, and I submit
I don't see how you can read those words differently.
Legally obligated
because
to
of physical injury, right? Physical injury causes something.
The policy says legally obligated to pay by reason of property damage.
By reason
liability
of,
because of property
of, right?
damage.
Property damage leads to other losses.
Maybe you should review the facts of Elger, because I thought that the same sort of thing happened in
Would
Elger.
Like
namely, that there was property damage, but then there was a decision not to extend coverage for other
Well, that's exactly right. There were two different types of losses in Elger. There was leaking plumbing systems, and like here we have leaking tanks. And the plumbing systems that leaked and actually damaged the homes and residences in which they were installed were characterized as property damage. And the economic damages that were suffered for the installation of these things that had never leaked was held not to be covered by the policies.
Mr. Swofford, are you familiar with the 05 Illinois Appellate Court case of Viking Construction? You don't cite it, and neither does Mr. Bryant. I commend it to both of you as to the language that speaks to because of property damage.
Oh, I'm not
it
familiar
might
with
just
it.
Inform your interpretation, both sides of the Supreme Court case of 01.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, we missed
Well, I think that both sides need to address it. It's obviously an intermediate appellate court case, but it is the case I find that speaks
Would
to,
you like to
the language speaks to the language contained in
You just like to address it in a supplemental authority under Rule 20?
No, that would be up to the presiding judge.
Sure, if you'd like to, that's fine. 10 a week.
Well, I'd also like the court to consider, and I'm running into my rebuttal time, but I also would like the court to consider it, that Illinois law and what an occurrence is, and I'm going to rely on my briefs for the distinction between what we say it means under cases like Wilfred's and what Microtherm says it means. But I do feel a little bit obligated to say that even under Microtherm's interpretation of expected and intended, that I would submit with these findings of knowing conduct and fraud that this leaking tanks had to be expected under Illinois law, and therefore this was not an occurrence. And I'd like to save at least some time for rebuttal.
Well, that's a little strange. I mean, the Texas court didn't find that these people intended to cause their heaters not to work, right?
That's true, but it's not intended alone. It's expected or intended, and expected is reasonable anticipation.
It's expected, obviously not.
Well,
they thought they could change the temperature without other adjustments. They didn't think there'd be any problem.
Well, the jury in the Texas case really found that they must have known the problem because they willfully and knowingly and fraudulently misrepresented the quality of these units to Microtherm.
Well, we don't really know, do we, what the Texas jurors were actually about the conduct of.
Actually, there's some pretty detailed findings in the verdict.
It's special issues, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
So what would you focus on in the special verdict as indicating that these people really were not just cutting corners but actually expecting?
They knowingly failed to disclose information about goods or products that was known at the time of the transaction.
Which question is it?
That's it. It appears on page 106 to 107 of the appendix. I'm not sure.
Okay. So it's question one.
The knowing finding may come a little bit later, Your Honor.
Okay. Well,
I saved my last 30 seconds.
Mr. Bryant?
Please, the court, counsel. My name is Steve Bryant. I represent Microtherm in this case. And I would like, if the court please to address this last question, because he raises the issue of the definition of knowing conduct and tries to ask the court you should infer intent or expected harm from this. If you read the instruction and the definition of knowing conduct, it only relates to conduct. Unlike the definition this court had in Calvert on recklessness, where it said an awareness of a substantial risk of harm, this does not refer to either expected, intended, likely, or anything else about damages. It pertains only to conduct.
But question three in the Texas special issues asks whether the defendants failed to comply with the warranty. And if you get up to question five, they break it down into quite a few subparts about knowingly that the goods or services failed to comply, knowingly representing that they're of a particular quality, knowingly failing to disclose. I mean, it's a fairly micro level of questioning for a jury.
There is.
But typical for Texas, actually. But
and, you know, the way those appellate lawyers went in there and decided that, I don't know, I was kind of barred from the proceedings while the appellate lawyers talked and got the special issues ready. But the knowing only refers to the conduct. And I believe the Illinois law, Texas law, Seventh Circuit law is pretty clear that conduct itself can be intentional, knowing, willful, can be reckless, so long as the harm is neither expected nor intended.
But
well, they knew they weren't following DuPont's recommendations, is that right?
They knew they were not following recommendations as to the processing temperatures, but as of the brief states, the processing temperatures are recommendations.
Right. But they also knew they were failing to comply with an express warranty, and they knew that the goods were not of the quality that they represented them to be.
Sure.
And so they knew, in other words, that they could fail. They weren't what they were. I mean, what does failure mean? Can't you have a little bit of common sense here?
That's a good question. That record was full of failures, not just the processing temperatures, but many other things. But let me give the court an example of how maybe knowing conduct does not equate to expected or intended harm. Let's take the warranty that a product is suitable for its intended purpose. Okay? That could be based on an engineering's miscalculation. And the engineer may go back later and say, gosh dog, I put the wrong X in here, which should have been Y, in order to make this projection. I was wrong, but I don't think any problem's going to happen. I think you'll still be okay in the field.
I'm not sure that's consistent with what the jury's verdict says in Texas, though. I mean, it's a hypothetical, of course, but maybe if we stick to these facts in this jury's verdict. Is that it strikes me that the sensible interpretation of what this jury found in this 27-page special verdict is that they did know that these units weren't going to perform as represented.
I think the evidence shows that they knew they were processing these things at low temperatures.
Why would you then say that you're not? The warranty isn't about the manufacturing process. The warranty is about the performance of the product in the hand of the buyer. So I don't think that the fact that they knew that they were using temperatures that were too low is something that the warranty worries about. No, the buyer doesn't really care how it was made as long as it performs as represented.
That's right. And the warranty is as to the fit, I believe, the fitness, quality, durability, performance, or use under the insurance policy. But again, and I'm not sure this is before this court, because I don't think it was raised in counsel's brief, but actually under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, there is a separate definition for intentional, and that's where you get into your intending harm. Knowing conduct, if you look at the definition, does not require that, but the intentional definition would. Now we can infer, and that's what I think.
Why can't we just look at question five,
okay,
which defines for the jury knowingly as actual awareness at the time of the conduct of the falsity, deception, or unfairness of the conduct in question, or actual awareness of the conduct constituting a failure to comply with a warranty? And it goes on and asks the jury all these particular questions, whether that's derived at some level from the Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act or whether that's derived from some generic pattern jury instruction isn't really the point. It's how does that map onto this particular policy?
Right. Well, maybe I can give the court an example of where a knowing misrepresentation or even an intentional misrepresentation does not equate to expected or intended harm, and I can do this from my personal experience. As a young student in college, I needed a job, so I applied at the maintenance shop to work on cars. And I really didn't know anything about cars, but I represented myself to be. The head mechanic had to leave, but the patrol car had to be pulled in. He said, this carburetor needs to be rebuilt. Have you ever rebuilt a carburetor before? And I said, sure, many times. He left. I have the package before me. Well, I can get the air cleaner off, and I can take the four bolts and pull the carburetor off. When I pull that carburetor out, I pull it apart this way as opposed to taking the top off, and a little round ball rose out across the table. I go, what in the heck was that? Well, I didn't know what it was. I didn't know where it went. I put it all back together, put it back on the car. That thing never worked right again. Did I intend to cause harm to the car? No, the misrepresentation was not
you
to cause
You may have been
harm.
Reckless.
I might have been mighty reckless. But I didn't intend to damage that patrol car.
But was it reasonably expectable that you would damage the car? Perhaps, yes.
I don't think it was even substantially certain that I would when I did it.
Well, I'm not sure that example helps you a lot, and I guess I'm leery of examples that take us too far from this
sure.
verdict or this case.
But the point...
But your client wasn't really making much of a claim under the Texas case for the actual property damages. The property damages were, for the most part, suffered by other people, as I understand it.
Oh,
your customers.
No, the actual record is replete with property damage. In fact, I cannot see how this case could have been brought without property
but
damage.
But the jury verdict isn't replete with property damage. The jury verdict is replete with non-property damage, aside from this rather small amount.
We did not submit questions to the jury as whether or not there was property damage or whether or not the property damage, the consequential damages flowed from the property damage.
Well, you may not have, but all you what you get, though, regardless of what the Texas jury was asked to do or not do, is for the most part, lost profits, past and future, damaged the value of the company. No question on this
right.
verdict that that happened. This was an extremely unfortunate event for Microtherm. The question about whether it's a knowing violation and all the rest of it, it's just not about, you know, your property. It's consequential, which is why I think, you know, we're all interested in how this policy goes out the line.
As Justice Posner pointed out, the consequential damages, if they flow from property damage, are specifically covered on the policy. Not only, we talked about this.
Even somebody else's property damage that wasn't yours?
I don't think ownership of the property is even an issue in the case, or can be. I believe the Seventh Circuit has addressed that, and I don't recall the case.
So if you sell this water heater to somebody, and they sell it to somebody else, and they sell it to somebody else, and then it fails, that's still enough property damage to bring in coverage under this policy?
If you're sued, yeah.
If there are lawsuits against a manufacturer, and no matter how far removed, and it comes back and his distributors mm-hmm. say, because of all these lawsuits, I'm not buying any more of your products. Sure, there's a causal relation. Mm-hmm. And that's what we had in this case. The testimony was it was the kiss of death when UPG Chambers started failing. His customers walked away.
That's right. And I guess I wonder if the kiss of death would have been any different if they had just sold you a lot of water heaters that failed to comply with the warranties and that, you know, you figure warranty costs are there and they stood ready to satisfy the warranty, give you a new heater, do whatever you needed.
You mean?
Give you a new lining, I guess I should say. Rebuild the heater.
No, I believe the testimony establishes that there was customer dissatisfaction because when the water heater develops a leak, you lose the use of the water heater, your dishwasher, everything you're washing.
But surely you would have to acknowledge that there are limitations on consequential damages. Suppose that somebody... somebody whose heater broke He got delayed. He had to fix the heater. As a result, didn't pay his taxes on time. You know, was had to pay a penalty to the IRS. There's a point at which the consequences of some catastrophe are so attenuated that there's no longer any liability.
I think what the court is asking is there some point where there's no more proximate cause?
So that hasn't really been litigated.
Has not been litigated. That would be an issue. That would have been an issue that should have been appealed to the appellate courts if that was really an issue in Texas, and as opposed to maybe a collateral attack. They could have appealed and refused to do so.
You're saying the defendant there should have or could have?
Ohio Cash would have the right under Texas law to take an appeal.
They did? Directly. I thought Texas was not a direct action state.
They have a right to take the appeal, though. The Fifth Circuit has addressed that issue very recently and said that an insurer...
But this was a state court action.
That is true.
So does the Fifth Circuit have the last word on the law of the state courts
they
of
don't.
Texas?
But following the Fifth Circuit decision, the Texas Supreme Court has said the same thing. And that is
so
that
even though the insurer can't be involved in the original trial level, the insurer can file the notice of appeal?
He can take the notice of appeal and appeal in his own right. There's a problem with that. Obviously, if you have a reservation of rights letter out there and you appeal the case and you're lucky and get it reversed and remanded and the jury comes back and hits you with twice as much as you got hit for the last time, they may have to answer to the insured for it. If you're taking the appeal, there are problems, but the insurance company has the right to take the appeal if the insurer does not. Now, I would like to address the issue of property damage in this case because there was more damage than just to the chambered parts itself.
But why? I mean, I guess my problem with the property damage is understanding, I guess, from the occurrence standpoint, why this is any different from cases like the Illinois court's case in Monticello, where there's some property damage, but that's not really what's being asked for, and the court's not allowing the consequential damages beyond the property damage.
What we have in this case is...
The value of the company is just not property damage. It's a different kind of damage. It's an intangible loss to the company.
Standing on its own, you're right. The court, you're right.
Yeah.
Now,
so we need to get from A to
okay.
B.
Your argument is that it's because of property damage.
Yeah, now, that's what I was saying.
What about this Elger case that your opponent...
The Elger case specifically only dealt with the definition of property damage. Did not address the because of language at all, in the opinion.
Although the outcome is certainly not particularly favorable to you, since there's damage to property and the cost to remove and replace the system, and the insurance policy is found to cover one thing but not the other.
Well, was that a because of policy? Did the court discuss that?
Now, I don't believe it was discussed in the court's opinion, the because of language.
Well, really, if the insurance is against property damage, then it doesn't include all this stuff. Because of property damage, that's your opening.
There is a case in Illinois from the Northern District, Hartford versus Kreider, that says consequential damages may be recoverable when they flow from damage to tangible property.
Well, again, it depends on what policy that court was looking at. I can certainly imagine writing a policy that says that.
Well, most courts that have interpreted this have the standard language and the general insuring agreement that Justice Posner referenced, because of property damage. And they say, based on that language, if the consequential damages are on account of physical injury to tangible property, or loss of use of tangible property not physically injured, which is the definition of property damage.
Mr. Bryan, you want us to read it as if it says due to property damage, right? You want because to be an equal sign to due, right?
Well, I would say on the authoritative treatise to say on account of, there's another issue when you're dealing with a PCOH provision, the product's complete operations provision. It doesn't say because of. It has the phrase arising out of, which is very broad. It covers everything. And so actually, if we're dealing with a defective product, as we are in this case, or services, defective services, under the PCOH provision, the test is arising out of, not because of.
Well, I don't see the difference between arising out of and because of. Because of, right? Something's a cause. That's your argument.
I agree.
Property damage caused these losses. That's.
I agree. Some courts have made that distinction. But in this case, going back, when these units leaked, keep in mind that a water heater can still be used. You don't know if you got a water leak until you see water on the floor, if you ever see it, or you don't get hot water. Because you have a frying pan.
Some of the leaks shorted the circuit boards, and so you weren't getting hot water.
They shorted the circuit board, which was a component part not manufactured by UPG, but manufactured by someone else. That alone constitutes property damage, physical injury to tangible property, not theirs. And what happens when you short the circuit board, shuts down the water heater. All of a sudden, you go to your water heater, you open it up, you see the leak. Now you have to turn the water off. You can't use your water heater. You can't use your dishwasher. You don't get showers. You don't get clean clothes. You don't get clean dishes. Customers complain. And after the complaints with the prior molder, Puget Plastics, that we just went through, and we go to our customers and said, we have found the problem. We've got a good molder this time. UPG, they're going to take care of the problem. And they say, we'll stick with you. And the first thing out of the bat, 65 failures under their policy period. And they just walk away. They say no more.
So you don't seem to be too concerned about the policy period, whether these 65 failures led to all of the loss of the company. It seems like that was actually a course of conduct, both from the prior supplier, from this policy period, and then from subsequent periods until the temperature gets fixed for the melt for this DuPont product and all the rest of it. Suppose one heater had failed during the policy period. Is that enough to hold these people for the entire loss of value of Microtherm?
If that was the evidence in the case.
Well,
I want
to know, out of 600,000, there were hundreds of thousands of these things sold. So if 65 fail, I'm just trying to figure out what's the significance of the policy period, because you are actually asking, since they're there, Ohio Casualty to cover the entire loss of value of your client, and yet not every heater that was manufactured that caused the loss of goodwill was manufactured during the policy period. As you well know, the insurance industry went through a great change from claims made to occurrence-based. Actually, the other way around, from occurrence-based to claims-made kinds of policies, so that people could know exactly what they were insuring. And I'm a little curious as to how small the number could be that would still make UPG and then ultimately Ohio responsible for the entire loss.
Okay, 2 points real quick. You raised actually 2 questions. One, the jury bifurcated how much Puget Plastics was liable for, how much Dana was liable for, and how much UPG was responsible for. So we know exactly what UPG was responsible for. And to answer the second question,
but UPG wasn't insured under this. There's only 1 year of a policy.
Right. The second question is could one failure cause all these losses? And if that's what the evidence shows, a 10-cent part can bring down an airliner.
The Texas case wasn't about property damage as such, right?
No, Your Honor. It was about this man's.
So how do we know that, what is it, $26 million or something that the jury awarded? How do we know that that's all a consequence of property damage?
Because the testimony is replete in the trial record. That's what caused it. You put in hot water heater, chamber ruptures, customer complains, shorts out circuit board, customer can't use the product, we got to replace it. It's all over the trial record. And there's testimony of causing.
How many did they replace?
Are you asking total or for Ohio Casualty policy period?
The policy period.
65, I believe. 65.
Well, I don't know how that gets up to 26 million.
Because the testimony established that the customers told Mr. Seiss and Microtherm they would stay with him since he has a new motor, okay, since they found the problem. And then when it started all over again and you have customers complaining and failures, they walked away. When customers walk away, whether it be one, two, or 65 failures, you lose a customer.
What really bothered the jury was the breach of warranty that Judge Wood was asking about. And that doesn't have anything to do with the property damage, right? If you had a trial focused, if you just a trial in this case, which the issue was, what were the consequences of the property damage? Not obvious that would come to $26 million.
Does the record show how many of these things were, and please answer, I mean, obviously answer that, but also would you please tell me how many units were sold during the policy period?
During the policy period, I want to say there were, I don't have that number right here. I believe it was something like 600. Maybe not.
Okay, that's fine. I'll find it.
It was a small fraction failed. In answer to your question, Justice Posner,
we're actually judges. We'd like to be justices, but we're just judges.
Okay, I apologize. The breach of warranty relates to the property damage. It's plain that without damage, you don't have a lawsuit. You can't file a lawsuit in Texas, and I'm sure in Illinois, you've got to have some type of damage to even file it. Well, when you look at the pleadings and the evidence, what was the damage here? The damage here was the failed parts, loss of use.
Imagine people saying, "I'm not going to buy from these people because their warranty is worthless."
I think we need to understand that the customer base we have, we're not 500,000 people, individuals. It was plumbing, supply, warehouses. There weren't that many customers. There might have been probably 60 to 70 distributors nationwide. Ferguson Supply was one of them, the trial record, one of the largest ones. When they hit, they walked away. We don't want it. We don't want the liability, and we don't want the problems of dealing with dissatisfied customers.
Mr. Bryan, I just wanted to say, you can tell me whether this is a reliable figure or not, but in the appellant's brief at page 10, it says Microtherm sold approximately 3,900 Sysco water heaters in 2001 containing chambers manufactured by UPG, and it cites to Defendant's Exhibit 1.21 at 32. So it looks to me, and then the 600 number I think that was sticking in your mind is the next sentence. At the time of the Texas trial, more than 600 chambers manufactured by UPG had failed.
Correct.
So I think the numbers are, and then the 65 seem to be the ones within the policy period.
That's correct. The most crucial time frame, according to the testimony.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bryan.
Thank you.
Mr. Swofford, how much time does he have? A minute?
I'm sorry for not having been more prepared about the because of language, but in Travelers versus Alger, they don't quote that part of the policy. In every other case, including the ones that Travelers versus Alger relies on, Diamond State, Bituminous, they contain that because of language. I would submit that Mr. Bryan has overstated what the evidence is replete with in the Texas case, because there's next to no evidence of property damage in that Texas case, and the citations are all in the brief. There's 100 of them. And this, if you want to focus on the because of, they lost their business because the heaters didn't work and the suppliers didn't want to buy heaters and distribute them if they didn't work.
Well, but if they didn't work because of the property damage.
Well, they didn't work because they didn't heat, regardless of any property damage.
No, what do you mean by regardless? If the tank hadn't been defective, they would have heated.
Yeah, the defect in the tank by itself is not property damage. That's just a defect.
I see. So you're saying is only when the tank leaks and damages the rest of the heater or the rug or something like that. That's
right. That's property damage. So,
right. So presumably, that actually related to what I was discussing with Mr. Bryant, that the property damage is limited and seems unlikely to have all by itself caused a $26 million loss. Isn't that...
Can't disagree with that. No, I mean, it's just, it's all out of proportion. You have $100,000 in the...
Now, how much... For you to have liability, since you're, you know, an excess insurer or something, for you to have liability, how big a damages number? Suppose there were a new trial in the district court here, just trying to figure out what were the consequences, the business losses resulting from property damage, narrowly defined, the tank actually causing physical damage to the rest of the heater or some property, other property. Okay. How much would the jury have to find in the way of damages in order for you to have to pay
$1 million?
In this particular case, they'd have to go over what's already been paid by other insurers, $4.3 million.
How much?
$4.3 million.
So if they found $4.3 million of, this is assuming that because of, assuming, you know, it's occurrence. So if they found $4.3 million consequences just of the property damage, narrowly defined, then you would owe some money to United Plastics, is that it?
Yes, correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel.